Station. We want to thank you for coming out and being our guest today. The format's going to be typical debate, with the exception that we will be taking questions via written notes for the last 15 minutes. And we'll be, we can pass those to the center. Our staff will pick those up, bring them to me, and as possible, we'll ask questions from 1:15 to 1:30, and then we'll adjourn possibly 1:30. We do have some free books up front, some literature. We're probably going to pick them up on your way out at your leisure. I want to thank our speakers today for taking time out of their busy schedule to come. Let me take this time to introduce them after I explain the basic structure. And they'll both be given 5 minutes to introduce themselves and their position. And following that, we'll have a statement, first of all, by Scott Lamont, followed by a three-minute rebuttal by Scott Richards. So don't get your Scotts mixed up. But that will be the basic format for the first 45 minutes, and then we'll have that time for questions, and you can pass those into the aisle on the outside, and Corey and Kevin will pick them up and bring them to me. Scott Richards, in the maroon shirt, is a pastor from Tucson, Arizona, where he serves at Calvary Christian Fellowship. He's also a nationwide radio host, a daily talk show, heard locally here in Albuquerque on KNKT. It's at 107.1 FM. Scott takes open line phone calls from 3 to 4 p.m. Mountain Time each weekday, and then teaches Bible studies both midweek and on the weekend here at Calvary Christian Fellowship in Tucson. He previously served on the staff of Chuck Smith at Calvary Chapel of Costa Mesa in California. And Scott has his bachelor's in communication arts from the University of Arizona, the Wildcats. And he also has his MDiv, his Master of Divinity in Biblical Language and Theology from Talbot Seminary in Southern California. So Scott, thanks for coming today.
Thanks for having me.
Our other Scott has both longer hair and a longer resume. And be glad to read that this time. Scott Chisholm Lamont is a registered nurse, poet, writer, activist, self-proclaimed tree hugger, and a priest of Wicca, originally from Calgary, Alberta, Canada. He is currently practicing at the University of New Mexico Health Services Center as an emergency and flight nursing educator and pediatric hospice nurse. Called by the goddess at a young age, he received his third degree initiation in 2000 and is now high priest of the Circle of the Winter Moon, a teaching covenant in the West Coast eclectic tradition. Scott holds elder clergy credentials to the Covenant of the Goddess, International Organization of Cooperating Autonomous Wiccan Congregations and Solitary Practitioners. He is the founder and a board member of Silver Moon Health Services, an organization of healers sponsored by the New Mexico Pagan Community, and is adjunct faculty at Ardente, a pagan seminary located in the Hamas Mountains, where he teaches leadership courses on topics such as ethics, communication, mediation, and consensus facilitation. He coordinates the hospital visitation program for the Children's Astral Sanctuary of the Healing Earth Wisdom, a non-denominational pagan church serving central New Mexico. Scott has lived all over western North America, from the Arctic Ocean to the Gulf of Mexico, to the Rocky Mountains to the San Francisco Bay. He now lives in Albuquerque with his wife, Shara, and his daughter, Michaela. And his nephew, Cameron. And also, he has two cats that control his life. His life, that is.
That's very true.
Finally, Scott likes to waste his free time dreaming about sailing around the world. Thanks again to both of you, and we're going to yield the floor, first of all, to Scott Lamont.
Thanks. So I have 5 minutes in which to touch upon a huge topic, and so I wrote down sort of some key points that I didn't want to leave out. This is just to give you the very most basic sketch, so let's leave it at that. So why don't I start with how I came to be here and how I came to this particular spiritual path. There were a lot of different spiritual influences on my life when I was younger. My parents, in particular, were very agnostic and so encouraged both my brother and myself to explore widely, and I have friends from various faith backgrounds, and I like to read. So I got to get a pretty broad overview of sort of what different spiritual belief systems existed. When I was a young teenager, I had a profound spiritual experience in the wilderness, which is where I like to retreat to when I was younger and still to this day, and I always found a great deal of meaning and support and connection in wild spaces. However, this particular experience I would best describe as having been touched by the goddess, by the divine, and had a sense of overwhelming beauty, connection, and love. And that has shaped my spiritual path and my spiritual vision from that point forward. Having said that, because paganism is so broad, I still had lots of terrain to explore and I did. And over the course of time, became aware of Wicca, which is one of many different paths, and eventually entered into formal training with a coven here in New Mexico. I actually trained with a couple of different ones before I settled on the path that I eventually trained on. Part of the reason for looking for a spirituality that emphasizes both experiential learning and experiential spirituality is that initial connection that I made in the wilderness was something that informed my understanding of what a spiritual experience and a spiritual life was. And so that was the sort of training that I was looking for. Probably the biggest reason why I settled on a formal religious path, as opposed to what most of my family and many of my friends did, which is sort of have a very vague spiritual understanding or a framework, but no real commitment to a particular path or a particular discipline theologically, was that I was looking for a framework to make sense of both the spiritual experience that I had then and also ones that I encountered over the course of my life. As a nurse, particularly working in critical care and then in hospice, I work with the dying a great deal. And my experiences with the dying have left me pretty much convinced that this physical existence is only one aspect of our existence, and that we are more than our bodies, that we do continue. And I have had the sense of people leaving as they die and presences when people are close to dying. And so these are the sorts of things that I was looking for a framework that would help me incorporate these experiences and make sense of them. So what is paganism? As somebody else said just moments ago, loaded term, a lot of people freak out when they hear the word pagan. And the word pagan is from the Latin, and it literally means somebody who lives in the country. And so it came to mean someone whose faith practices, whose belief systems were those of country dwellers. So they were not the urban folk, they were the rural folk. Heathen is another word that you will hear used primarily by people who follow Northern European traditions, means essentially the same thing. It literally meant somebody who lived in the heaths or who lived in a house that had a sod roof, a roof made of heath. So those terms eventually evolved to mean people who had not converted to primarily Christianity as it moved into Europe, and eventually even became a term of derision or sort of suspect beliefs. And that is part of our cultural heritage collectively. Pagan faiths are nature-based positive faiths. They view the divinity as being generally polytheistic, or at least understood as a duality of both men, feminine and masculine. They tend to be pantheistic or even panentheistic, which basically means that everything is of divinity. Everything, the divinity can be found everywhere. It is in everyone. It is in every living thing. And therefore is imminent. It's accessible. Pagans do not tend to believe that we need any kind of intermediary to have legitimate spiritual experiences or even to connect directly to the divine. The divine is everywhere, within us, within everyone. Modern paganism is a reconstruction. So you will hear people talk about, you know, Wicca being this ancient religion. Not true. It's a reconstruction. It is rebuilding things a lot because, unfortunately, historically, some of the conversions in Northern Europe, particularly during a benighted section of our history, were, shall we say, not necessarily user-friendly. And so what happened was a lot of these faiths disappeared. And so our understanding of them nowadays as modern people are taken from archaeological investigation. So they're not true records. They are a reconstruction of findings. They are taken from reports of those who came in to the place where these people were living, whether it be the Romans or the Irish monasteries. So these were people who were interpreting it through the filter of their worldview. And they reported what they saw as important and meaningful and didn't necessarily record things that they didn't consider to be important. So there are multiple different paths within pagan spirituality. Wicca is the one that you will hear about most often, probably because it's the largest, gets the most press. Asatru, I would be willing to bet most of you have not heard of, also known as heathenism or Odinism, which is the Norse tradition, which is actually probably the best preserved because a lot of their liturgy was saved in the original language in Iceland. So there's a broad range. Druidism, modern Druidism is also a reconstruction, whereas some of the modern shamanic practices are truly contiguous, going back as far as we can tell. I have a friend locally who is shamanic from a shamanic household of Sami descent, and they never lost their traditions.
Okay, we'll cause that to be our introduction. Scott Richards.
Well, thanks, Scott. I think probably most of you would respond by saying that a lot of what Scott had to share is eye-opening. Most people do not understand pagan traditions or even more specifically Wicca, especially this time of year. I imagine you guys are on a major campaign against disinformation cauldrons and folks with long noses and warts and what have you. But, you know, it's an interesting thing that Scott began by sharing his spiritual journey. If you'll indulge me, I'll do the same. The fact that I'm sitting here before you talking about spiritual issues at all, to me, is a really, it's proof positive that in my mind, God does have a sense of humor. Because similar to Scott, our backgrounds are similar. In fact, we do both have two cats in our home that run our lives. But even beyond this, I was raised in a home that could charitably be called agnostic. I was raised by an attorney. And that was a challenging thing. I had to present legal briefs to get the car keys growing up. And my parents' background was largely, my mom, I think, would characterize herself as sympathetic towards Christian ideas, but largely agnostic. And my dad was pretty much a confessing atheist. He felt that religion was a crutch for weak people who needed help sleeping at night or little old ladies. But, you know, you're a Richards. You can go and do whatever you want to do. And so because I really admired my dad and respected my dad, I adopted his set of beliefs. I considered myself to be an atheist as well. Interestingly enough, when I entered into high school, I began to attend, you talk about forced conversions, I began to attend a Fellowship of Christian Athletes group because my football coach, who was also my physics teacher, was leading the group. My playing time and my grade needed all the help that they could get, so I began showing up. And after these meetings, I would pretty much take to task those who were believers who would show up these things, talking about how irrational all of this was. How can you believe this? But, you know, science has proven evolution. You people are living in the dark ages. And interestingly enough, I kept going because my friends were going and my coach was there. Well, long story short, Before Easter, my coach read an article from the Journal of the American Medical Association on the physical death of Jesus Christ from a doctor's and from an archaeological point of view. And I was absolutely blown away by that. My view of Jesus and his suffering on the cross came straight off the stained glass and, just the very traditional Renaissance images of the northern European-looking guy, maybe a couple drops of blood, neatly placed crown of thorns, polished marble-looking cross. But to make a long story short, to discover that Jesus was so savage before he got to the cross that you could hardly recognize him as a human being anymore, that blew my mind. And again, being raised in an inquisitive academic home, I walked out of that meeting saying, if I don't know this about Christianity, what else do I know? And that began to plant some seeds. Well, a few months after that, our group went to an event put on by the Billy Graham Organization, where for the very first time, this was really shocking to me, for the very first time, with all the interactions that I'd had with Christians down through time, and believe me, I'd argued with the best of them. I think they all wanted to put a notch on their Bible to get me as a convert. Not a single one of them had shared with me the most profound and simple truth of Christianity. That God loves us. That God understands that we are fallen, sinful people separated from him. And yet he has provided a way back through sending his son to die on that cross. You see, for the first time I understood that when Jesus was dying, he wasn't dying as some archaic act of history or some inspirational thing that satisfied some people philosophically. It was his personal way of paying the price, a price I could never pay for my own faults, flaws, mistakes, the meanness in my life, the anger in my life, the times where I've just been cruel and really flat out inhumane to other people in my life. A price I could never pay, he willingly paid. And when that was explained to me, and it was explained to me that one could have a personal relationship with God by asking Christ to come into your life, to know him personally, well, I responded to that invitation. Believe me, I never thought I'd be the type to go forward at a Billy Graham event. You probably see these things on TV. But I went forward, and going into that event, I would say I went in as an atheist, but I came out with a personal relationship with God connected to that love. Now, I could go into detail about the basic tenets of Christianity. I think I've covered some of that. But again, this is a debate. And as it is a debate, it does inevitably reach a point of disagreement and a different set of perspectives on life. And here's the issue. This is the nub of it. In my studies of paganism, and I really appreciate the information that you sent along. It's very, very helpful. Nice other research independent of this. I bet you never thought you would hear a Christian spokesman say this, but I think there's a lot about Wicca in particular and paganism in general that is absolutely commendable, that I would support. The fact that you communicated already in your experiences, particularly in deathbed situations, I bear witness to the same thing, even with my own dad passing away last year. When people die, it is a spiritual experience. I would tell you that if I'd been a stone-cold atheist, and witness the difference 5 minutes makes between someone who is alive and someone who is dead, I would have had to reconsider my point of view, because there really is something beyond all of this, and Wicca affirms this, and I think that's commendable. There is more to life than news, weather, and sports, and I think we need to think about that. Secondly, I think Wicca is commendable in its ethic. The essence of Wiccan ethics, and since you teach on this, you can fill in blanks around this, but I think a good summary statement is, do others no harm. You can have your own decisions about life. You make autonomous choices, but do not do others harm. Well, in these days, when you flip on cable news and you see the incredible damage being done by people in the name of religion that does people an untold damage and harm, I think if more people had that kind of ethic, we'd have a better world. So I think that's a commendable part of this faith system. The other thing that Wiccans tend to believe that I think is something that I wholeheartedly as a Christian support is their great respect for the environment. I mean, we are coming to a place where literally we're making environmental choices which, may affect generations beyond us now. Technology hasn't solved our problems, it's just compounded them. I think the fact that Wiccans take a high view of being good stewards of the environment that we have been given is a very commendable thing. But where we would differ is this. Christianity maintains a radical fact, a fact that I believe can be verified in history, that we are a visited planet. And by that I mean God has visited us, has appeared to us, has manifested himself to us in the person of Jesus Christ. Jesus presented his credentials for being God in human flesh by living a life unlike any life that has ever been lived, a life of moral perfection, a life whose teaching is preserved down to this day and still rocks the world of people 2,000 years removed from the event. But the most important thing about Jesus Christ, and this was a life changer for me, was coming face to face with the historical evidence for his resurrection from the dead. If Jesus claimed to be God, claimed to show us the way to a relationship with God, and backed up that that claim by rising from the dead in a moment of history, which I believe is a very important and very, very well-attested fact of history, well then, instead of being eclectic in our approach, we should run, not walk, to the record of what he had to say about reality. You see, Christianity is true not just because it is satisfying to me personally, which it is, and has impacted my life in experiential ways, but it is true objectively as well. It's a foundation that will not fail us. And so when it comes to ethical choices, when it comes to how we approach spirituality, when it comes to these all-important questions that we have to wrestle with, what is life all about? How do we relate to our fellow human being? What lies beyond this life? We all agree that we check out and the essence of who we are leaves at that point. Where do they go? How can we know that the afterlife will be a positive thing for us? Well, I believe these questions are answered in the person of Jesus Christ. And that, I think, is the essential difference between our two points of view.
Scott, let that serve as your introduction. Mr. Lamont, would you take 3 minutes to explain the distinctions of paganism?
Well, I will do my best. Let me start with this point, because I think it sort of speaks to some of the differences in worldview. One of them is that pagans, a lot of the teaching that they look for, both that they share down through generations, but also what they look for personally, can be taken from their own experiences in the natural world. And so one of the examples of this that and the reason why this particular season comes around again is the perspective of a cyclical existence, that our the foundation of our experience as human beings is cyclical. And so this is one of the reasons why most pagans at least support the idea of reincarnation, because it matches the cyclical nature that we can see in the world around us. And so it is from that perspective that there is less concern about having someone act as an intermediary, I think that's the best way I could put it, by absolving you of sin. And we really don't have the same conceptual framework around sin or wrongdoing. So rather, we see this as an element of personal responsibility, that you as a spirit who happens to be having an incarnate existence, you have to do the work of perfecting yourself, of moving forward as a spiritual being, of recognizing the connection that is inherent, and the idea of a disconnect from God, if you will. There's not really an exactly congruent perspective in pagan theology. The idea instead would be more that we live with an illusion that we are separate, and that the spiritual work that we have to do is to recognize our connection. This is one of the reasons why the world itself is so important to us. This is one of the reasons why actual physical experiences, sensuality, time spent with people, time spent out of doors are all important, because the world itself is not separate from us. It is all connected. We are, you know, to take a rip off of the old nail polish things, you know, you're soaking in it. You're soaking in it. Divinity is everywhere. The world and everything in it is sacred. The other thing about the pagan ethic that comes out of this that's more challenging, and most people are not as familiar with, The Wiccan read actually reads, "And affirm them, do what you will." And most people take the "do what you will" and think that that means it's kind of a free-for-all. As long as you don't hurt anyone, it's okay. That is actually a misinterpretation. I would call it sort of a naive approach. Will is your highest self, your deepest core spiritual being, connecting with divinity. That means that you have to search within yourself for that connection with the divine and to make an enlightened decision, recognizing that harm to others, because they are really the same as ourselves, should be avoided, but also recognizing that in incarnate existence, it is impossible to live without harming something else. Even if you just eat a carrot, the carrot is alive, it has a life, it is sacred. So you have to take responsibility for your choices and your actions, and whether or not you really probe deeply for asking yourself, your most divine self, the most connected part of yourself, is this the appropriate thing to do? Does this serve my highest purpose and the highest purposes of all those beings that I will interact with, some of whom I can't know in advance what that interaction is going to be?
Mr. Richards, 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Well, sure. And once again, Scott, I think you very eloquently expressed the fact that your faith system is a very compassionate one and does emphasize these things. But where Christianity, I think, would disagree with your point of view is this idea that everything that we see is an all-encompassing oneness. This basically emerges out of Eastern thought more than anything else. Philosophically, it's called monism, that you're God and I'm God, everything is God, everything is made up of God's stuff. The Bible's point of view is very different from this. The Bible says that God is separate from his creation. He is immanent, able to be known, but separate from his creation. The Bible also states that although God created the heavens and the earth and created them very good, which is an emphatic term in Hebrew, without fault or flaw at all, because of the high and holy responsibility that he invested in man to be the one that would oversee this creation for him, to enter into a relationship with him based on love and live in harmony with him and with in relationship with him, man exercised his free will and chose to rebel against God. And the rest, as they say, is history. We live in a world that the great Christian writer C.S. Lewis once said is as close as a sinner will ever get to heaven and as close as a saint will ever get to hell. Because we see aspects of both of these things in the creation. The Bible affirms, for instance, in Psalm 19, that the heavens declare the glory of God and the firmament shows forth his handiwork. We can see aspects of who God is. His great power, his creativity, his amazing wisdom and insight in the creation around us. However, another Christian writer by the name of Francis Schaeffer once quoted that this creation we live in right now, including us as human beings, is like a magnificent ruin. I had the opportunity to go to the country of Belize last summer and visit some of the Mayan ruins down there. And they're very, very impressive, but they're absolutely unlivable now. I mean, the creation, in a sense, has reclaimed all of these things. And so we as human beings are kind of in that same interesting dichotomy. We are not as bad off as we can be when the Bible says that we are fallen, but we are as separate from God as we can possibly be without his intervention, without his mercy, without his kindness and compassion. The idea that all is one, all-encompassing oneness, I believe, is a doctrine that, well, quite frankly, it's very difficult to live with in practicality, because it says, in essence, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, so obviously you can correct me, but in Eastern thought, it says that there ultimately is no difference between, say, love and hate, kindness and cruelty. It's all the same stuff. Any distinction that we see is just an illusion. Now, that's very difficult to live with. Again, A writer, Susan Schaefer McCollum, talked about an incident where they were talking about different ideas of reality with a fellow who was a Hindu at the University of Cambridge. And he was putting forth this point of view, this monism, this all is one and one is all, and God is just, it's all God's stuff. And one of the people listening on was struck with how this philosophy just did not line up with reality. So what he did was he took a, they were about ready to have some tea, the steaming kettle of tea was boiling over a nice hot fire there in Cambridge. He took the kettle of tea and held it over the Hindu's head and said, so if what you're saying is true, that there ultimately is no difference between kindness and cruelty, between love and hate, that it's all just an illusion, it's all just a perspective, then it really doesn't matter whether I pour this water on your head or not. And the Hindu left him without comment because he could not match his professed philosophy with reality. I guess that's one of the reasons why I continue to be a Christian, because I see the Christian worldview, and it's like a key reality that fits exactly right. It teaches me that people are of infinite worth and value because they're made in the image and likeness of God, their creator. It also teaches me that when I see people behaving in ghastly and ungodly ways, this is not an unexpected phenomenon, but rather a symptom of a spiritual disease, the fallenness of man, a disease that Jesus Christ paid the ultimate price, laying down his own life on a cross to provide a cure. For God so loved this world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believes in him should not perish but have everlasting life. That's the Christian worldview, and that would be a real distinction between our points of view.
I would disagree that the pagan worldview is a monism point of view. Pantheism or panentheism, I would agree with, but not monism. Part of the idea that divinity is reflected within everyone comes from the concept of essentially a Godhead, in other words, a font of creation that allusion to the Big Bang, for example, that it is all of the potential energy, all of the potential beingness, all gathered into one space, and it can spring forth and give rise to anything. And that is what happened. It is each layer of that creation leaps forth. It begins to differentiate so that we are constantly looking at fragments of the original. So each of us is recognizable as unique because we are, in essence, if you can think of it like the facets of a diamond, we are tiny little facets of the divine. And even the gods and goddesses that have been named over time are, in and of themselves, more complex, more complete facets of that same whole. But ultimately, beyond our ability to even comprehend in our existence as we exist right now, is the ultimate oneness source that led to creation. And part of our struggle as spiritual beings is to return to that oneness at some point. But this is like coming around again to learn the lessons again. We do things that are wrong and inappropriate, not because we are inherently flawed, but because we are inherently growing. We are inherently learning. And if you think about how a child develops, they will make the same mistakes, sometimes ad infinitum, and you've done body training too, I'm sure, so you have an idea of what this is like.
Both sides,
there you go. So the idea being that you are coming around again and trying to learn those lessons. Part of the reason for being incarnate as spirits is because there are experiences and interactions that you can't have any other way. The reason that we exist in this state is so that we may better ourselves and evolve. And so this comes back to part of, I think, a basic theological difference in worldview, is that unlike particularly the Abrahamic faiths, which view God as not only a singular who is transcendent, although approachable, but also unchanging, paganism does not necessarily support the idea of the goddess as unchanging. Even though we might conceive of her as being all of the universe that may be unbounded and even existing beyond that, the universe exists within the body of the goddess, but it is not the totality of her. But she is not unchanging. She may come around to the same point again, just like we do. Her time frame's a tad different than ours. It's measured in billions of years, not lifespans. And our worldview as human beings, you and I interacting here, is short. You know, we joke about how short-term politicians think about things, but really, as human beings, our frame of reference is very, very short. And so you need multiple lifetimes, multiple interactions with each other to return to each other and work out ties that you've made to each other. One of the things that pagans often do borrow from Eastern thought is the idea of karma, which is the idea that your interactions lead to an ongoing relationship, a relationship that persists beyond your current incarnation, and that if there are things that you've done to each other that are harmful, that limit your growth, that stifle you and stymie your reach back towards the source that is all, you have to meet again and resolve it. One of the principal karmic laws is that if you don't learn the lesson, you have to repeat it. It's like a very, very strict elementary school.
Yeah, and you know, again, we see a distinction here. The faith system that you advocate is, even in its name, I think is very revealing. It is an eclectic system.
Yes.
It is one that borrows from many different traditions and ideas. I think it's interesting some of the concepts of reincarnation that you borrowed, you know, as opposed to resurrection, which would be the Christian worldview. And you know, one of the things about reincarnation, I think most Western people don't realize, is that from an Eastern point of view, reincarnation is not a good thing. It is something that you want to get out of at all costs. Gandhi himself was once quoted saying, reincarnation is a burden too great to bear. And the caste system that we see in India, which does an incredibly oppressive thing, it's great if you're a Brahmin, but if you're a Dalit in India, you are consigned to abject poverty. You are consigned to the worst menial labor. You cannot advance yourself. You cannot educate yourself. Because this karmic system declares you've got to learn your lesson here. You were born a Dalit because in your previous life you did something that requires you to be here. And so when a Mother Teresa comes in to Calcutta and begins to extend compassion for the dispossessed, those who buy into reincarnation go, this is the worst thing that you can possibly do for these people because they're not learning the lesson they need to learn. Well, I understand their point of view. I cannot agree with it. It is an incredibly oppressive point of view, and that's what led Gandhi to believe that he came to. The reincarnation that you are advocating here is a very westernized one. It does borrow from kind of an evolutionary Darwinistic concept that, you know, in every way, every day, we're getting better and better. But it's certainly not an Eastern idea. And I'm not saying that you guys are promoting Eastern mysticism. But this idea of being eclectic, this idea of picking and choosing, also comes down to a key distinction between Christianity and the pagan worldview. Christianity would say that we can lay hold of eternal truth, not by, in a sense, trial and error, coming back and hoping we get it right next time, not by life after life after life, but rather by the revelation that God has given to us. If God, who exists above and beyond time, who has created us for this time on earth, and you and I would agree that this time we have on earth is an incredibly important spiritual time. It's incredibly important. In fact, from a Christian point of view, it's an eternity-deciding point of time. The Bible says it is given to man once to die, and after this comes the judgment. You get this life, and what you do with it, saying yes or no to a relationship with God, is really what this life is all about. You're here to make that decision. That's the Christian worldview. We don't get another shot at it, if you will. The problem I really have with reincarnation is twofold. First of all, it's a nice concept, but it's entirely subjective. There's no historical evidence that someone has come back, unless, of course, and please don't take this as being disrespectful. I saw one of those tabloid magazines where I was taking out at the grocery store not too long ago. It said, reincarnation proven, baby born with pirate's peg leg. I mean, we just don't see that kind of evidence, you see, of people coming back from another life. I mean, there's people who say they've gone through regressive therapy and under hypnosis, but we're getting into really tenuous places in those kind of altered states of consciousness. I would say, contrary to that, there is hard historical evidence to back up the Christian claim that Jesus Christ rose from the dead 3 days after dying on that cruel Roman cross. And if that's the case, then, and I know this is a distinction between our worldviews here, so I say it with this disclaimer. If that's the case, then reincarnation and resurrection cannot coexist. One is true or the other, but not both. And we've got to ask ourselves a question. What's going to be our source of authority? Is it going to be how I look at life, or am I going to look at the life of Jesus Christ and consider him my source of authority? I think I went longer than 3 minutes there.
But. You're doing fine. We have time for two more interchanges. But if you have a question, right now would be time to jot it down on a piece of paper, pass it to the aisle, and then Kevin can bring it up to me, and we'll present it to both gentlemen.
So we're covering a lot of ground here.
Are you having a good time?
Absolutely. It's been interesting, that's for sure. There are a variety of ways of looking at reincarnation that have been expressed. And so one of the challenges, I think, as people, is that all of these different spiritual systems, all of these different teachers throughout time, and that's just recorded time, right? There were spiritual teachers long before we wrote anything down. So we don't know exactly what was taught before. Is that people are making their best interpretation of what they were taught, what their experiences, how their system of logic works. So unlike the monotheistic faiths that have a written word that they follow, I think that paganism does not make any profound truth claims beyond what is specifically demonstrable through the natural world. Pagans tend to be very fond of science because they see it as another way of looking at and learning from the natural universe that we exist in. I think that the example that you gave of how the case system works, which I would agree is terribly oppressive, is one where a belief system has been used to validate and support a social and political system which benefits a very small group of people who get to be on top. And if you're on top, it's a great system. If you're not on top, it ain't so hot. So one of the things that paganism tends to be is very egalitarian. So there are no special gurus. There is no hope. There is no book. So it is.
I don't go for that concept either.
I know about that. there is no ultimate authority. One of us is engaged in feedback.
Yeah.
There is no authority, and the recognition of the subjectiveness of spiritual experience is actually kind of part of the point. It means that you have to approach other people's spiritual experiences and beliefs and interpretations with a great deal of respect, because there is no way for you to know how they came to that spiritual system without knowing them long and personally. There is no way to state your perspective as an absolute. What you can do is you can share as two beings on a journey what your best understanding is based on your subjective experience of what things seem to be common, and therefore approach the possibility of a truth claim. But it makes no ultimate truth claim. It makes no statement about absolutes. Reincarnation is an idea, one which for some of us has some basis of experiential evidence, or a group of people who seem to have similar experiences and so forth. So there's a group of anecdotes that seem to support it. But we would make no absolute claims that, I was a farrier in a past life or something like that. I certainly wouldn't make that. I think the biggest piece out of the eclecticism is that just as we are both the same and unique, we are looking for things that make sense as we evolve as people, as we evolve as a society, as our worldview changes. The filter that you and I here in this room share as common ground, if we were having this discussion 200 years ago, this would not be the discussion we would be having. Why? Because the experiences that you and I have had in our lifetimes in this society are not consistent with the experiences of those people. If we were talking to people during the time of the Romans, it would be once again a completely different system. And even historically, the Abrahamic faiths have changed over time, and there have been new outgrowths of thought and understanding. Some of them have come from their contact with other cultures. And somebody says, wow, you know, that actually makes sense. There's something behind what these other people are teaching. Part of the basis or the rationale for using eclecticism is that just as we are all facets of the divine, therefore we are all facets of a truth that is essentially unknowable, but each of us carries a tiny piece of it. And if we listen carefully to each other and listen respectfully, then we can get closer to that larger truth. We can get closer to growth as a spiritual being. And even the idea of resurrection, I would disagree. The resurrection and reincarnation can't exist together. Who is to say, for example, that we do not have to journey back multiple times, either on this planet or other planets? There may be other intelligent beings in the universe who make the same struggle towards understanding and what their place is in that larger universe as we do. So we don't know how many iterations we might go through, but at some point, ultimately, the divinity and us may meet again. And that, in a way, to me, would represent a resurrection. You are returned to the font.
Scott makes some terrific questions. Given the time frame, here's what I'd like to say. We're going to end at 1:30, and there's some great questions here. I'm going to present them by email to both of our guests, and we'll try to post them online along with the audio version of today's message by via podcast. It'll take a couple of days, but it'll be at m88.org. You can check that website. This is a radio station presenting our time. Let me ask the question, first of all, to you, Scott, and it shouldn't need a rebuttal, but you're welcome to give one. And that is,
I was ready for us to have a course.
Yes.
Scott Richards, the question is for you. If Christianity is based in love, why is it so often presented with fear and hatred?
Well, once again, I think that's an excellent question. You know, in my research into Wicca, you know, one of the things that I did do some reading through were the burning times that are referred to here. And, you know, when I read about the burning times, the thing that hit me right off the top was a sense of sympathy. Because the burning times were essentially generated by individuals that had become committed to a bureaucratic organizational structure that was basically running the show in society. And any kind of protest, any kind of deviation from the norm, boy, you talk about the old Russian proverb, it's the nail that sticks up that gets hammered down. That was the way of the world in those situations. The interesting thing to me is, and this is why I say I have sympathy for it, it wasn't just witches that were getting burned during the burning time. I think about the story of John Huss, one of the early reformers who looked at the doctrines of, say, the Roman Catholic Church at that time, and said, these differ from the teachings of the Bible. Well, what did that get Huss? It got Huss a bonfire party in his honor in the streets of Prague. And I mean, one of the most tragic things that happened in all that is they were going to burn him at the stake for having the nerve to share biblical truth with people. Was this little old lady came up with the first light to put on his fire, and Huss looked at this little old lady and shook his head and said, here is true faith. This woman truly believed what she had been taught by this system, so much so she was willing to watch someone burn to death for all of it. I guess my point about the burning times and people who try to represent Christianity, and I'm right there with you. Before I was a Christian, that was one of my main objections to the Christian faith. Christians! And they used to be mean and cruel to me. You know, I'd get in a debate with them, and they'd look at me like, well, I know where you're going after you die, and quite frankly, I think it's a good idea. So, You know, like I said, it took going to a Billy Graham movie to hear for the very first time that God loved me. Now, this is my answer to the question. This is why I don't call you to follow a church. This is why I don't call you to follow some hierarchical system that somebody's put in place. I call you to follow Jesus Christ, because Jesus dealt with people very differently from all of that. In the Gospel of John, chapter 8, for instance, a woman caught in the very act of adultery was pushed to the front by the religious leaders of his time and said, "Hey, Moses' law says to stone this one. What do you say?" Well, they were looking at Jesus like the cat that ate the canary. They were so pleased with themselves. If Jesus said, "Well, the law's the law, go ahead and get the rocks," they could say, "Oh, Mr. Compassion, what a hypocrite." If he said, no, don't stone, I'd say, "Oh, well, you don't believe in the law of Moses. He's a heretic, let's stone him." But what does Jesus do? Well, in this account, we're told that Jesus says nothing. He simply stoops down and starts writing in the dust. And then after a while, he straightened up and looked at him and said, "All right, well, let the one who's without sin cast the first stone." And then he stooped down and wrote in the dust again. And the scripture says that beginning with the oldest, Jesus' adversaries began to slink away. I'd give anything to know what he wrote in the dust. I have a feeling it was places and dates and things that these guys were involved with that they didn't want to have done publicly. And finally, Jesus left alone with a woman. Jesus said to the woman, "Woman, where are your accusers? Does no one condemn you?" And she said, "No one, Lord." And he said, "Neither do I condemn you. Go and sin no more." Now here we see the balance. Go and sin no more. Don't indulge yourself in this destructive behavior that's hurting you and other people and destroying other marriage relationships. But also receive the compassion of God. That's what I want to follow. I don't want to follow some kind of hierarchical system that has been put together. I want to follow Jesus Christ, and that's what I challenge you to do.
Let me
have
a little question. The question is,
Mr. Lamont, how could anyone be good enough to live up to karma's standards?
Live often. Good thing that the sun looks like it's going to rise again tomorrow, isn't it? It is not easy. But I think that this is a point where I think any of the faiths would actually kind of agree. It is not easy to lead a spiritual life. It is not easy to have the awareness of self and others and divinity and put that all together and live that, not just think about it, but live it as part of your reality every day. One of the criticisms that I've heard of sort of an eclectic approach to spirituality, I would call it sort of the loosey-goosey approach, is that there's no real discipline behind it. In other words, you're not making a focus to really try to discern, well, what is this lesson that I'm trying to learn from my own path or from someone else's path, from someone else as a spiritual teacher, or from my own internal experiences with divinity, and how am I applying it? How am I working on improving myself? And how am I with other people and with other beings in the world? That is a discipline, and that is the difference, I think, between stating that you believe something and believing something enough that you live it. That's why it's hard work.
In the interest of time, we want to close promptly at 1:30. I want to summarize the questions and give you each 2 minutes to close, because we talked about a wide variety of topics today. And I think the general question we're here to answer is to conflict and to contrast what the belief systems are about what happens after death. And I want to give both gentlemen the opportunity to say how their faith structure treats that moment. What do you believe happens? We'll start with Scott Richards. What do you think happens at the moment of death for a human being?
Well, once again, the Bible doesn't leave this to guesswork. And if we are dealing with a source authority who has gone through the process and come back to tell us about it, Jesus, who died on a cruel Roman cross and rose from the dead 3 days later, this is something we need to pay attention to. I think I mentioned this passage early on. It's found in the book of Hebrews, chapter 10, verse 29. It is given to man once to die, and after this comes the judgment. The Bible tells us that each and every human being is put here on planet Earth to make a decision to say yes or no to a relationship with God. Now, that relationship aspect is very important to understand, because God calls us to a love relationship with himself. He could have made us marionettes. He could have caused us just to dance to his tune, line us up, and let us go through our motions. But the fact that a love relationship is so important to God, he gave us a free will. He gave us a free choice. And he realized what the consequences of investing such a powerful, yet potentially destructive gift could be in the hands of his creation. And yet, even though we've misused that free will, God loved us so much, he became a man in the person of Jesus Christ, lived a perfect life so that he could lay down that life for you and me, pay a price that he didn't have to pay, but willingly and lovingly paid for you and me, so that you and I could enter into a relationship with God that has no end. Jesus himself defined eternal life in John 17:3. He said, "This is eternal life, that they may know you, the only true God, and Jesus Christ, the one whom you have sent." The Bible defines heaven not just as an existence, not just as something where, you know, we're not just going to be out there in some ethereal beyond, but it also defines it as a relationship. And I always wondered, would people be bored in heaven? You know, you get to live forever? Wow, that's a long time. Especially if you're just floating on a cloud wearing an unstylish robe and plunking on a harp. You know, I mean, beats the other place, but you know, one thing I've learned in this life about relationships is this. My wife, Pam, she is just the most wonderful person. And, you know, we've been married now for 13 years. And, you know, sometimes you just laugh because it just gets better and better as we go on. We go through the ups and downs and everything that you have in a relationship. And when I'm spending time with her, it just flies. It just flies because you're with someone that you love so much. Well, that's how the Bible defines eternity. Eternity is not going to be like some endless church service that never gets out. It sounds more like the other place to me, but it's going to be enjoying that relationship with God. And as we come to Jesus, put our faith in what he has done for us, paying a price we could never pay, living a life we could never live, we can enter into that blessing. We can enter into that hope of everlasting life.
Paganism makes no truth claims about what happens after we die. What we believe as a mystery religion, which is what these sorts of faiths are. They're mystery religions. They're not revealed religions. They're not written down. It's about the experience, and it's about your progress as a spiritual being. The stories that are told, so one of them, for example, is the traveling over the Western Sea to the Summerland, to the Isles of the Forever Young, where apples grow and healing waters flow forever, to rest and recuperate and learn from our last life before we try again. It's a story. It's a way of understanding what the potential journey of our spirit is. But it's also a mystery. And so one of the things that I think makes paganism maybe a little harder to work with as a spiritual path is that it doesn't give you absolute answers. It lets us live with the mystery. It lets us live with the dichotomous possibility of more than one thing might happen, and we don't know. And the only way to know is to experience it. So when we die, we believe that we continue in some way, that we return to divinity in some way, and that we return again to meet each other again. That our separateness is another way of finding love, that it is about learning to recognize the self in the other and yearning for that rejoining. And that is the mystery of death.
Gentlemen, thank you both very much. Audience for being kind and respectful. I certainly appreciate that. We'll post the information again at m88.org. I'll get to class.